Welcome, everybody, to Savitri on Infinite Conversations. This is Marco Morelli, and I'm here with Jeffrey Jen and Andrea and John Robert. It is now 2022, and we left off last year with the last canto of Book 6, the Book of Fate. And today we're going to begin on Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 1. The joy of union, the ordeal of the foreknowledge of death, and the heart's grief and pain. And after our opening meditation, Jeffrey Jen will begin the reading. Oh, excuse me, was Jeffrey Jen, right? Okay.
Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 1, the joy of union, the ordeal of the foreknowledge of death, and heart's grief and pain. Fate followed her foreseen immutable road. Man's hopes and longings build the journeying wheels that bear the body of his destiny and lead his blind will towards an unknown goal. His fate within him shapes his acts and rules. Its face and form already are born in him. Its parentage is in his secret soul. Here, matter seems to mold the body's life, and the soul follows where its nature drives. Nature and fate compel his free will's choice. But greater spirits this balance can reverse and make the soul the artist of its fate. This is the mystic truth our ignorance hides. Doom is a passage for our inborn force. Our ordeal is the hidden spirit's choice. Ananke is our being's own decree. All was fulfilled. The heart of Savitri flowers sweet and adamant, passionate and calm, had chosen, and on her strength's unbending road, forced to its issue the long cosmic curve. Once more she sat behind loud hastening hooves, a speed of armored squadrons, and a voice far heard of chariots bore her from her home. Accouchant, earth wakened, in its dumb muse, looked up at her from a vast indolence. Hills wallowing in a bright haze, large lands that lolled at ease beneath the summer heavens, region on region spacious in the sun, cities like chrysolites in the wide blaze, and yellow rivers pacing, lion-maned, led to the shallower march's emerald line, a happy front to iron vastnesses and austere peaks and Titan solitudes.
Once more, once more was near the fair and fated place, the borders gleaming with the grove's delight, where first she met the face of Satyavan, and he saw, like one waking into a dream, some timeless beauty and reality, the moon gold sweetness of heaven's earth-born child. The past receded and the future neared. Far now behind lay Madras' spacious halls, the white carved pillars, the cool dim alcoves, the tinged mosaic of the crystal floors, the towered pavilions, the wind-rippled pools and gardens humming with the murmur of bees. Forgotten soon, or a pale memory, the fountain's splash in the white stone-bound pool, the thoughtful noontide's brooding solemn trance, the colonnade's dream gray in the quiet eve, the slow moonrise gliding in front of night. Left far behind were now the faces known, the happy silken babble on laughter's lips, and a close clinging clasp of intimate hands, and adoration's light in cherished eyes offered to the one sovereign of their life. Nature's primeval loneliness was here. Here only was the voice of bird and beast, the ascetic's exile in the dim-souled, huge, inhuman forest, far from cheerful sound of man's blithe converse and his crowded days. In a broad eve, with one red eye of cloud, through a narrow opening, a green-flowered cleft out of the stare of sky and soil, they came into a mighty home of emerald dusk.
There onward, led by a faint brooding path which toiled through the shadow of enormous trunks and under arches misers of sunshine, they saw low thatched roofs of a hermitage huddled beneath a patch of azure hue in a sunlight clearing that seemed the outbreak of a glad smile in the forest's monstrous heart, a rude refuge of the thought and will of man, watched by the crowding giants of the wood. Arrived in that rough-hewn homestead, they gave, questioning no more the strangeness of her fate, their pride and loved one to the great blind king. A regal pillar of fallen mightiness, and the stately, careworn woman, once a queen, who now hoped nothing for herself from life, but all things only hoped for her one child, calling on that single head from partial fate, all joy of earth, all heaven's beatitude. Adoring wisdom and beauty like a young god's, she saw him loved by heaven as by herself. She rejoiced in his brightness and believed in his fate and knew not of the evil drawing near. Lingering some days upon the forest verge, like men who lengthen out departure's pain, unwilling to separate sorrowful clinging hands, unwilling to see for the last time a face, heavy with the sorrow of a coming day, and wondering at the carelessness of fate, who breaks with idle hands her supreme works. They parted from her with pain-fraught, burdened hearts, as forced by inescapable fate, we part from one whom we shall never see again. Driven by the singularity of her fate, helpless against the choice of Savitri's heart, they left her to her rapture and her doom in the tremendous forest's savage charge.
All put behind her that was once her life, all welcomed that henceforth was his and hers. She abode with Satyavan in the wild woods. Priceless she deemed her joy so close to death. Apart with love, she lived for love alone. As if self-poised above the march of days, her immobile spirit watched the haste of time, a statue of passion and invincible force, an absolutism of sweet, imperious will, a tranquility and a violence of the gods, indomitable and immutable. Shall we pause there? Or should we go all the way to the end, maybe? And
I wanted to say I found some of the writing here difficult to understand. The phrasing was a bit strange. Is right at the beginning. The most clear one of that is halfway down the first page. All was fulfilled. The heart of Savitri, flower sweet and adamant, passionate and calm, had chosen on her strength's unbending road, forced to its issue the long cosmic curve. I don't get it, you know. I don't know if anybody can help with it, but it doesn't seem to be a regular sentence somehow.
Would it help if you read it, all was fulfilled that the heart of Savitri, flower sweet and adamant, passionate and calm, had chosen on her strength's unbending road, forced to its issue the long cosmic curve?
Well, it would help with that, but it would help to put a comma at the end of the third line as well. It all seems to be run together.
I didn't get it when I read it first either, and I thought, well, I have to think about that one. I kind of want to diagram the sentence.
Yeah, I would have liked to see a comma after all was fulfilled, because it doesn't flow this way for me.
Yes, so a comma there, or that you put in, John Robert. I think the comma there actually makes more sense. I think it almost makes sense, the sentence, if it had a comma there.
Yeah.
But how could it be wrong? Is there...
Well...
Well, he's not perfect, Aurobindo, I don't think.
There was a lot of editing done. So maybe this was something...
I mean, the whole section we just read, that was the worst bit, but there are the parts that the phrasing seemed a little bit choppy, a little bit a little bit difficult the way it was. I'd have a harder time finding other examples, but buried in that text, it wasn't that easy to figure out what was going on.
I would agree, and I also would want to read it again and see if it becomes clearer through the reading. Also, do we understand the setting? Because we've just left this scene with Savitri and her parents, the king and queen. Now she's returning Satyavan. And then there's a kind of, I think, almost like a fantasia or reminiscence of what's being left behind. And then the asceticism that Satyavan is living in, the difference between the world of the palace and the world of human society, and then this special environment, which is in the forest and is also in communion with these other forces. The forest's monstrous heart, the crowding giants of the wood. And then there's the reference to the great blind king and a stately careworn woman, once a queen. And then there is a kind of vision of Satyavan and the corresponding one of Savitri and their kind of beatific state here. So is that something you got, perhaps Andre or John Robert?
Who is the great blind king?
He's the father of Satyavan.
Dhyumatsena is his name.
Dhyumatsena.
Yeah. And the queen is Dhyumatsena's wife and Satyavan's mother. The thing I was wondering about, I read somewhere recently that Ashwapati and his queen accompanied Savitri back to the hermitage. And Shrivana doesn't say that in here, but there is some accompaniment because people are leaving. Mm-hmm. But I'd never heard that before, that her parents went with her. So I was surprised to hear that or to read that.
Right. I thought it was just, a courtly accompaniment of mm-hmm. all her journey. She is a princess after all. Yeah, no, that would be very surprising.
So another thing I imagine, the story of Savitri and Satyavan is taken from the mythology of Indian mythology. So mm-hmm. I imagine the forest is part of that myth. I don't know the original myth, but because when I read this part about the forest, I feel this connection with Dante's Inferno, the woods, and it has a very kind of dark, foreboding almost sense that it gives here, right? Also the association with death and the forest and death, which is one doesn't think of death when one thinks of the forest, unless one thinks of Dante.
Isn't it true that traditionally monks and ascetics would do their practice in the forest and yeah. hermitages would be established in the forest?
Yeah.
So that would be that would be going back to the Vedas, and I know also in the Buddhist tradition, yeah. There's a forest.
And of course, in the foothills of the Himalayas, because he described these massive iron mountains, right? Behind the woods, there's lots of woods, It's a whole wooded region of the country.
But is this the forest monster's heart? This is not a classical description of a forest where one has monks and ascetics. It's something very different going on here.
I thought it was particularly symbolic too. It seemed symbolic to me, perhaps an allusion to the role of fate that is still looming over this year of practice or yoga. But perhaps it'll become more apparent as we continue reading. Shall I?
Sure.
At first, to her beneath the sapphire heavens, the sylvan solitude was a gorgeous dream, an altar of the summer's splendor and fire, a sky-topped, flower-hung palace of the gods, and all its lit scenes a smile on rapture's lips, and all its voices bards of happiness. There was a chanting in the casual wind. There was a glory in the least sunbeam. Night was a chrysoprase on velvet cloth. a nestling darkness or a moonlit deep. Day was a purple pageant and a hymn, a wave of the laughter of light from morn to eve. His absence was a dream of memory. His presence was the empire of a god, a fusing of the joys of earth and heaven, a tremulous blaze of nuptial rapture past, a rushing of two spirits to be one, a burning of two bodies in one flame. Opened were gates of unforgettable bliss. Two lives were locked within an earthly heaven, and fate and grief fled from that fiery hour. But soon now failed the summer's ardent breath, and throngs of blue-black clouds crept through the sky, and rain fled sobbing over the dripping leaves, and storm became the forest's titan voice.
Then, listening to the thunder's fatal crash and the fugitive pattering footsteps of the showers and the long unsatisfied panting of the wind and sorrow muttering in the sound-vexed night, the grief of all the world came near to her. Night's darkness seemed her future's ominous face. The shadow of her lover's doom arose, and fear laid hands upon her mortal heart. The moments swift and ruthless raced, alarmed her thoughts, her mind remembered Narad's date. A trembling moved accountant of her riches. She reckoned the insufficient days between, a dire expectancy knocked at her breast. Dreadful to her were the footsteps of the hour. Grief came, a passionate stranger, to her gate, banished when in his arms. Out of her sleep it rose at morn to look into her face. Vainly she fled into abysms of bliss from her pursuing foresight of the end. The more she plunged into love, that anguish grew. Her deepest grief from sweetest gulfs arose. Remembrance was a poignant pang. She felt each day a golden leaf torn cruelly out from her too slender book of love and joy. Thus swaying in strong gusts of happiness and swimming in foreboding somber waves and feeding sorrow and terror with her heart, for now they sat among her bosom's guests or in her inner chamber paced apart. Her eyes stared blind into the future's night. Out of her separate self she looked and saw, moving amid the unconscious faces loved, in mind a stranger, though in heart so near, the ignorant smiling world go happily by upon its way towards an unknown doom and wondered at the careless lives of men.
As if in different worlds they walked, though close, they confident of the returning sun, they wrapped in little hourly hopes and tasks. She, in her dreadful knowledge, was alone. The rich and happy secrecy that once enshrined her as if in a silver bower, apart in a bright nest of thoughts and dreams, made room for tragic hours of solitude and lonely grief that none could share or know. A body seeing the end too soon of joy and the fragile happiness of its mortal love. Her quiet visage, still and sweet and calm, her graceful daily acts were now a mask. In vain she looked upon her depths to find a ground of stillness and a spirit's peace. Still veiled from her was the silent being within who sees life's drama pass with unmoved eyes, support the sorrow of the mind and heart, and bears in human breasts the world and fate. A glimpse or flashes came. The presence was hid. Only her violent heart and passionate will were pushed in front to meet the immutable doom. Defenseless, nude, bound to her human lot, they had no means to act, no way to save. These she controlled. Nothing was shown outside. She was still to them the child they knew and loved, the sorrowing woman they saw not within. No change was in her beautiful motion seen. A worshipped empress all once vied to serve, she made herself the diligent serf of all, nor spared the labor of broom and jar and well, or close gentle tending, or to heap the fire of altar and kitchen, no slight task allowed to others that her woman's strength might do. In all her acts, a strange divinity shone. Into a simplest movement, she could bring a oneness with earth's glowing robe of light, a lifting up of common acts by love.
All love was hers, and its one heavenly cord bound all to all with her as golden tie. But when her grief to the surface pressed too close, these things, once gracious adjuncts of her joy, seemed meaningless to her, a gleaming shell, or were a round, mechanical, and void. Her body's actions shared not by her will. Always behind this strange divided life, her spirit, like a sea of living fire, possessed her lover and to his body clung, one locked embrace to guard its threatened mate. At night she woke through the slow, silent hours, brooding on the treasure of his bosom and face, hung o'er the sleep-bound beauty of his brow, or laid her burning cheek upon his feet. Waking at morn, her lips endlessly clung to his, unwilling ever to separate again, or lose that honeyed drain of lingering joy, unwilling to loose his body from her breast, the warm, inadequate signs that love must use. Intolerant of the poverty of time, her passion, catching at the fugitive hours, willed the expense of centuries in one day of prodigal love and the surf of ecstasy. Or else she strove even in mortal time to build a little room for timelessness by the deep union of two human lives, her soul secluded, shut into his soul. After all was given, she demanded still, even by his strong embrace unsatisfied, she longed to cry, "O tender Satyavan, O lover of my soul, give more of love, while yet thou canst to her thou lovest. Imprint thyself for every nerve to keep that thrills to thee the message of my heart. For soon we part, and who shall know how long before the great wheel in its monstrous round restore us to each other and our love."
Too well she loved to speak a fateful word and lay her burden on his happy head. Too well she loved to speak a fateful word and lay her burden on his happy head. She pressed the outsurging grief back into her breast to dwell within silent, unhelped, alone. To dwell within silent, unhelped, alone. But Satyavan sometimes half understood, or felt at least with the uncertain answer of our thought-blinded hearts, the unuttered need, the unplumbed abyss of her deep, passionate want. All of his speeding days that he could spare from labor in the forest, hewing wood, and hunting food in the wild sylvan glades, and service to his father's sightless life, he gave to her and helped to increase the hours by the nearness of his presence and his clasp, and lavish softness of heart-seeking words, and the close beating felt of heart on heart. All was too little for her bottomless need. If in his presence she forgot a while, grief filled his absence with its aching touch. She saw the desert of her coming days imaged in every solitary hour. Although with a vain imaginary bliss of fiery union through death's door of escape, she dreamed of her body robed in funeral flame. She knew she must not clutch that happiness to die with him and follow, seizing his robe across our other countries, travelers glad into the sweet or terrible beyond. For those sad parents still would need her here to help the empty remnant of their day. Often it seemed to her the age's pain had pressed their quintessence into her single woe, concentrating in her a tortured world. Thus, in the silent chamber of her soul, cloistering her love to live with secret grief, she dwelt like a dumb priest with hidden gods, unappeased by the wordless offering of her last days, of her days, lifting them her sorrow like frankincense, her life the altar, herself the sacrifice.
Yet ever they grew into each other more, until it seemed no power could rend apart, since even the body's walls could not divide. For when he wandered in the forest, oft her conscious spirit walked with him and knew his actions as if in herself he moved. He, less aware, thrilled with her from afar. Always the stature of her passion grew. Grief, fear became the food of mighty love. Increased by its torment, it filled the whole world. It was all her life. Became her whole earth and heaven. Although life born, an infant of the hours, immortal, it walked unslayable as the gods. Her spirit stretched measureless, measureless in strength divine, an anvil for the blows of fate and time. Or tired of sorrow's passionate luxury, grief's self became calm, dull-eyed, resolute, awaiting some issue in its fiery struggle, some deed in which it might forever seize, victorious over itself and death and tears. The year now paused upon the brink of change. No more the storms sailed with stupendous wings and thunder strode in wrath across the world, but still was heard a muttering in the sky, and rain dripped wearily through the mournful air, and gray, slow-drifting clouds shut in the earth. So her grief's heavy sky shut in her heart, a still self hid behind, but gave no light. No voice came down from the forgotten heights. Only in the privacy of its brooding pain, her human heart spoke to the body's fate. End of Canto One.
So I am curious about the scene here, because there's it sounds like there's a daily life that Savitri is taking part in, and she's like helping in service, you know, in service roles, and cooking and cleaning and doing things like that. So when we imagine this hermitage, should we not be seeing it as a totally solitary kind of place where there's only Satyavan? Are there also others around, kind of like the ashram might be? I didn't sense that there was Savitri's mother and father here, as like John Robert, you mentioned. So,
No, they're not there. No, they all left. Everybody left, leaving her to her love and her fate. So she's there herself with Satyavan, and they have apparently a little place in the woods, deeper in the woods. And then the parents, and they probably have a staff of servants, because they were, after all, royalty, right? There will be a group of people around them, and maybe other practitioners of, you know, asceticism or whatever. But and so then they both serve his parents for their, you know, their daily life.
Okay. And she's also thinking that when Satyavan leaves, she'll have to stay behind and continue helping out.
And take care of the parents, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this would also relate perhaps to Indian like marriage customs and...
The woman always goes to the husband's house, lives in the house with the husband's parents, usually, and then that's her life. She has left her own family. She will not return.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So in the last, I think it's in the epilogue at the end of Savitri, after the adventure of Satyaman's death and what happens after that, and when they come back, they've been gone. To us, it will seem like ages because of all the things that happened, but it's really only like the afternoon and evening, and people are out looking for them. So this seems to indicate what Andrea was saying, that there's a small group of people there. I've also read pieces by Indian women who live here in the United States and who don't want to go back to India, go back to that life, because it means their life is very circumscribed then by family. And they're under the command of their mother-in-law to take care of the household and all those things. So that's what I envision of Savitri doing in this situation. Not in that rigid kind of way is probably found in some households, but basically that pattern that that Andrea was talking about.
So I was also noticing that this isn't a Hollywood film. In a Hollywood film, you would get, you know, all of this rising action leading to the consummation of this love affair. And you would have this long drawn out sequence of the love affair before you hit anybody with the fact that he's going to die. That would be much later on that you would finally get this, he's not going to make it. This is not that. It's all about the death rather than the life together, really, right? I mean, the life together is maybe two lines in this or a half a dozen lines, and that's it.
Well, GJ, I'm really glad you noticed this is in the Hollywood film.
It is is very charged with this. It's like the grief and the fear that she feels is like supercharged her passion. If I were in Satyavan's, it could seem overwhelming, I imagine.
Yes, it sounded a little overwhelming. I've just been the kind of through that myself. The bottomless need. Pretty intense.
There also the division that she did, like she's living a kind of double life.
She's having a secret. She has this whole thing as a huge secret.
She hasn't shared it with Satyavan at this point.
No, with nobody. So he just feels all this ominous, huge stuff inside of her, but she does not explain. I think she wants him to be as happy as possible as long as he's alive, you know, without having to share the foreboding that she has.
I was thinking about what we were talking about a minute ago about the intensity of her feeling, and I was visualizing their cosmic life together. I mean, when they meet, they realize that they've known each other for millennia in various lives, and all that comes to focus in this one year. Especially now that she knows that they only have 1 year together.
Some of the lines that stood out for me in relation to that intensity and the secret. We're on 471. Her always behind this strange divided life, her spirit like a sea of living fire possessed her lover and to his body clung, one locked embrace to guard its threatened mate. At night she woke through the slow silent hours, brooding on the treasure of his bosom and face, hung o'er the sleep-bound beauty of his brow, or laid her burning cheek upon his feet. And then there's a few lines down. Her passion catching at the fugitive hours willed the expense of centuries in one day of prodigal love and the surf of ecstasy. That reminded me a bit of what you were just saying, John Robert, about the how all that cosmic passion gets condensed into this 1 year. And then just going on, that she strove even in mortal time to build a little room for timelessness by the deep union of two human lives, her soul secluded, shut into his soul. It's interesting too, and I wonder what you would reflect on this, how, you know, in the first number of books, we're following Satyavan's path, or Ashwapati's and Satyavan's path, and now we've shifted focus to Savitri, and we've been through some of the same stages, it seems, like similar anyway, like where there's this a descent into darkness, or this becoming enclosed in an idea or in a particular frame of reality. And it seems that Savitri is going through her own cycle of this now.
Yeah, so this is called the book of yoga is Savitri's yoga.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it starts all over, because now it's her journey. And her journey will be radically different, of course, from Ashwabhakti's. But so this is about her yoga, and it begins with this for knowledge and suffering.
And are there 12 books? So this is like the seventh book. It's like halfway in the number of books, not in the length, but in the number of books, I think, maybe.
Yeah, there are 12 books, the 12th book epilogue.
Yeah, that was my memory, is there 12 books. So even though we're much more than halfway through, it's still the book seven. It's the half of the canto of the books are done, and we're starting the next set of books, right? So there is a kind of logic to that as well.
Symmetry, right?
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Shall we read it again?
Yeah, somebody else needs to start. So,
I think you just
read the last bit, so you'll start on the next one. Yeah,
I will. Yeah.
Okay.
Book 7, the Book of Yoga. Canto 1, the joy of union, the ordeal of the foreknowledge of death and the heart's grief and pain. Fate followed her foreseen immutable road. Man's hopes and longings build the journeying wheels that bear the body of his destiny and lead his blind will towards an unknown goal. His fate within him shapes his acts and rules. Its face and form already are born in him. Its parentage is in his secret soul. Here, matter seems to mold the body's life, and the soul follows where its nature drives. Nature and fate compel his free will's choice. But greater spirits this balance can reverse and make the soul the artist of its fate. This is the mystic truth our ignorance hides. Doom is a passage for our inborn force, our ordeal is the hidden spirit's choice. Ananki is our being's own decree. All was fulfilled. The heart of Savitri, flower sweet and adamant, passionate and calm, had chosen, and on her strength's unbending road, forced to its issue the long cosmic curve. I want to read that line again now. All was fulfilled, the heart of Savitri, flower sweet and adamant, passionate and calm, had chosen, and on her strength's unbending road, forced to its issue the long cosmic curve. Once more she sat behind loud hastening hooves, a speed of armored squadrons and a voice far heard of chariots bore her from her home. A couchant earth wakened in its dumb muse, looked up at her from a vast indolence. Hills wallowing in a bright haze, large lands that lolled at ease beneath the summer heavens, region on region, spacious in the sun, cities like chrysolites in the wide blaze, and yellow rivers pacing lion-maned, led to the Shalva's marches, emerald line. A happy front to iron vastnesses and austere peaks and titan solitudes.
Once more was near the fair and fated place, the borders gleaming with the grove's delight, where first she met the face of Satyavan, and he saw, like one walking into a dream, some timeless beauty and reality, the moon gold sweetness of heaven's earthborn child. The past receded, and the future neared. Far now behind lay Madras' spacious halls, the white curved pillars, the cool dim alcoves, the tinged mosaic of the crystal floors, the towered pavilions, the wind-rippled pools and gardens, humming with the murmur of bees, forgotten soon, or a pale memory, the fountain splash in the white stone-bound pool, the thoughtful noontides, brooding solemn trance, the colonnades dream, gray in the quiet eve, the slow moonrise gliding in front of night. Left far behind were now the faces known, the happy silken babble on laughter's lips, and the close clinging clasp of intimate hands, and adoration's light in cherished eyes offered to the one sovereign of their life. Nature's primeval loneliness was here. Here only was the voice of bird and beast, the ascetic's exile in the dim-souled, huge, inhuman forest, far from cheerful sound of man's blithe converse and his crowded days. In a broad eave, with one red eye of cloud, through a narrow opening, a green-flowered cleft, out of the stare of sky and soil they came, into a mighty home of emerald dusk.
There onward led by a faint brooding path, which toiled through the shadow of enormous trunks, and under arches, misers of sunshine, they saw low thatched roofs of a hermitage, huddled beneath a patch of azure hue, in a sunlit clearing that seemed the outbreak of a glad smile in the forest's monstrous heart, a rude refuge of the thought and will of man, watched by the crowding giants of the wood. Arrived in that rough-hewn homestead, they gave, questioning no more the strangeness of her fate, their pride and loved one to the great blind king, a regal pillar of fallen mightiness, and the stately, careworn woman, once a queen, who now hoped nothing for herself from life, but all things only hoped for her one child, calling on that single head from partial fate, all joy of earth, all heaven's beatitude. Adoring wisdom and beauty like a young god's, she saw him loved by heaven as by herself. She rejoiced in his brightness and believed in his fate and knew not of the evil drawing near. Lingering some days upon the forest verge, like men who lengthen out departure's pain, unwilling to separate sorrowful, clinging hands, unwilling to see for the last time a face heavy with the sorrow of a coming day, and wondering at the carelessness of fate, who breaks with idle hands her supreme works, they parted from her with pain-fraught, burdened hearts, as forced by inescapable fate we part from one whom we shall never see again. Driven by the singularity of her fate, helpless against the choice of Savitri's heart, they left her to her rapture and her doom in the tremendous forest's savage charge.
All put behind her that was once her life, all welcome that henceforth was his and hers. She abode with Satyavan in the wild woods. Priceless she deemed her joys so close to death. Apart with love, she lived for love alone, as if self-poised above the march of days, her immobile spirit watched the haste of time, a statue of passion, an invisible force, an absolutism of sweet, imperious will, a tranquility and a violence of the gods, indomitable and immutable. At first, to her, beneath the sapphire heavens, the sylvan solitude was a gorgeous dream, an altar of the summer's splendor and fire, a sky-topped, flower-hung palace of the gods, and all its scenes a smile on rapture's lips, and all its voices bards of happiness. There was a chanting in the casual wind. There was a glory in the least sunbeam. Night was a chrysoprase on velvet cloth, a nestling darkness or a moonlit deep. Day was a purple pageant and a hymn, a wave of the laughter of light from morn to eve. His absence was a dream of memory. His presence was the empire of a god, a fusing of the joys of earth and heaven, a tremulous blaze of nuptial rapture past, a rushing of two spirits to be one, a burning of two bodies in one flame. Opened were gates of unforgettable bliss. Two lives were locked within an earthly heaven, and fate and grief fled from that fiery hour. But soon, now failed the summer's ardent breath, and throngs of blue-black clouds crept through the sky, and rain fled sobbing over the dripping leaves, and storm became the forest's titan voice.
Then, listening to the thunder's fatal crash, and the fugitive pattering footsteps of the showers, and the long unsatisfied panting of the wind, and sorrow muttering in the sound-vexed night, the grief of all the world came near to her. Night's darkness seemed her future's ominous face. The shadow of her lover's doom arose, and fear laid hands upon her mortal heart. The moments swift and ruthless raced, alarmed her thoughts, her mind remembered Narad's date. A trembling moved accountant of her riches. She reckoned the insufficient days between. A dire expectancy knocked at her breast. Dreadful to her were the footsteps of the hours. Grief came, a passionate stranger to her gate. Banished when in his arms, out of her sleep it rose at morn to look into her face. Vainly she fled into abysms of bliss from her pursuing foresight to the end. The more she plunged into love, that anguish grew. Her deepest grief from sweetest gulfs arose. Remembrance was a poignant pang. She felt each day a golden leaf torn cruelly out from her too slender book of love and joy. Thus swaying in strong gusts of happiness and swimming in foreboding somber waves and feeding sorrow and terror with her heart, for now they sat among her bosom's guests or in her inner chamber paced apart. Her eyes stared blindly, blind into the future's night. Out of her separate self she looked and saw, moving amid the unconscious faces loved, in mind a stranger, though in heart so near, the ignorant smiling world go happily by upon its way towards an unknown doom, and wondered at the careless lives of men.
As if in different worlds they walked, though close. They, confident of the returning sun, they, wrapped in little houry hopes and tasks, she, in her dreadful knowledge, was alone. the rich and happy secrecy that once enshrined her, as if in a silver bower, apart in a bright nest of thoughts and dreams, made room for tragic hours of solitude and lonely grief that none could share or know. A body seeing the end too soon of joy and the fragile happiness of its mortal love. Her quiet visage still and sweet and calm, her graceful daily acts were now a mask. In vain she looked upon her depths to find a ground of stillness and the spirit's peace. Still veiled from her was the silent being within, who sees life's drama pass with unmoved eyes, supports the sorrow of the mind and heart, and bears in human breasts the world and fate. A glimpse or flashes came, the presence was hid. Only her violent heart and passionate will were pushed in front to meet the immutable doom. Defenseless, nude, bound to her human lot, they had no means to act, no way to save. These she controlled. Nothing was shown outside. She was still to them the child they knew and loved, the sorrowing woman they saw not within. No change was in her beautiful motions seen. A worshipped empress, all once vied to serve, she made herself the diligent serf of all, nor spared the labor of broom and jar and well, or close gentle tending, or to heap the fire of altar and kitchen. No slight task allowed to others that her woman's strength might do. In all her acts a strange divinity shone. Into a simplest movement she could bring a oneness with earth's glowing robe of light, a lifting up of common acts by love.
All love was hers, and its one heavenly cord bound all to all with her as golden tie. But when her grief to the surface pressed too close, these things, once gracious adjuncts of her joy, seemed meaningless to her, a gleaming shell, or were around mechanical and void. Her body's actions shared not by her will. Always behind this strange divided life, her spirit, like a sea of living fire, possessed her lover and to his body clung, one locked embrace to guard its threatened mate. At night she woke through the slow, silent hours, brooding on the treasure of his bosom and face, hung o'er the sleep-bound beauty of his brow, or laid her burning cheek upon his feet. Waking at morn, her lips endlessly clung to his, unwilling ever to separate again, or lose that honeyed drain of lingering joy, unwilling to loose his body from her breast, the warm, inadequate signs that love must use. Intolerant of the poverty of time, her passion catching at the fugitive hours, willed the expense of centuries in one day of prodigal love and the surf of ecstasy. Or else she strove, even in mortal time, to build a little room for timelessness by the deep union of two human lives, her soul secluded, shut into his soul. After all was given, she demanded still. even by his strong embrace unsatisfied. She longed to cry, O tender Satyavan, O lover of my soul, give more of love while yet thou canst, to her thou lovest. Imprint thyself for every nerve to keep that thrills to thee the message of my heart. For soon we part, and who shall know how long before the great wheel in its monstrous round restore us to each other and our love.
Too well she loved to speak a fateful word and lay her burden on his happy head. She pressed the outsurging grief back into her breast to dwell within silent, unhelped, alone. But Satyavan sometimes half understood, or felt at least with the uncertain answer of our thought-blinded hearts, the unuttered need, the unplumbed abyss of her deep, passionate want. All his speeding days that he could spare from labor in the forest hewing wood and hunting food in the wild sylvan glades and service to his father's sightless life, he gave to her and helped to increase the hours by the nearest of his presence and his clasp and lavish softness of heart-seeking words and the close beating felt of heart on heart. All was too little for her bottomless need. If in his presence she forgot a while, grief filled his absence with her with its aching touch. She saw the desert of her coming days imaged in every solitary hour. Although with a vain imaginary bliss of fiery union through death's door of escape, she dreamed of her body robed in funeral flame, she knew she must not clutch that happiness to die with him and follow, seizing his robe across our other countries, travelers glad into the sweet or terrible beyond. For those sad parents would need her here to help the empty remnant of their day. Often it seemed to her the age's pain had pressed their quintessence into her single woe, concentrated in her, a tortured world. Thus, in the silent chamber of her soul, cloistering her love to live with secret griefs, she dwelt like a dumb priest with hidden gods, unappeased by the wordless offering of her days, lifting to them her sorrow like frankincense, her life the altar, herself the sacrifice.
Yet ever they grew into each other more, until it seemed no power could rend apart, since even the body's walls could not divide. For when he wandered in the forest, oft her conscious spirit walked with him and knew his actions as if in herself he moved. He, less aware, thrilled with her from afar. Always the stature of her passion grew. Grief, fear became the food of mighty love. Increased by its torment, it filled the whole world. It was all her life, became her whole earth and heaven. Although life born, an infant of the hours, immortal, it walked unslayable as the gods. Her spirit stretched measureless in strength divine, an anvil for the blows of fate and time. Or tired of sorrow's passionate luxury, grief's self became calm, dull-eyed, resolute, awaiting some issue of its fiery struggle, some deed in which it might forever cease, victorious over itself and death and tears. The year now paused upon the brink of change. No more the storm sailed with stupendous wings and thunder strode in wrath across the world, but still was heard a muttering in the sky, and rain dripped wearily through the mournful air, and gray, slow drifting clouds shut in the earth. So her grief's heavy sky shut in her heart. The still self hid behind, but gave no light. No voice came down from the forgotten heights. Only in the privacy of its brooding pain, her human heart spoke to the body's fate. End of Canto One. So I find it really interesting. I'm just the little paragraph before this last, where grief's self, so grief is embodied here as an entity, right? Grief's self became calm, dull-eyed, resolute, awaiting some issue of its fiery struggle, some deed in which it might forever cease, victorious over itself and death and tears.
I was fascinated by the line right before that, or tired of sorrow's passionate luxury.
Yeah.
And the line before that is an anvil, that is her spirit, two lines, stretched, measureless in strength divine, an anvil for the blows of fate and time. That image of that hard anvil just being whacked by fate and time, and also that look, that it brings to mind just some a visage of that kind of grim determination one has when one is struggling a lot and has a sense of deep purpose or has a sense of deep direction, but can't express the joy or can't feel free and relaxed with it like that, because there's the transition from that passionate luxury of sorrow to that that calm, dull-eyed, resolute, that grief self, like you said, personification of grief, and that look of I think determination, or that brooding kind of look, and just before that, the grief and the fear are the food of mighty love that are increased by the torment to the point where they fill the whole world, and they're immortal, unslayable as the gods. This was a very potent encapsulation of this state.
It's packed. It's packed.
Marco, I was wondering about that. Those lines you just quoted, increased its torment. Increased by his torment, it filled the whole world. So I was wondering, I thought at first it was grief and fear, but it says it's not there. So then I thought maybe he's talking about love. Love increased by its torment. Love filled the whole world.
Uh-huh.
It was all her life, became her whole earth and heaven. I think it was the love that
he's
talking about there.
Not the food. Yeah.
So I'm changing the subject slightly, but there's a presence of green throughout this canto. Those two words that we didn't understand when we read them, I didn't anyway, chrysoprase and chrysolite, they're both green gems. And he talks about emeralds a lot.
Yes.
green tinge something, or, you know, so there's a lot of green running through this. So maybe it's interesting too that the green is in the stones and not the trees.
The forest is always described as emerald.
Yes, yeah, okay. So but anyway,
they get the
link between the stones and the yeah, so it's interesting. Yeah.
Long green, very earthy.
But it's clearly a conscious choice, is what I'm getting at. One doesn't dig out these unusual words if it's not a conscious choice.
The bottom of 466 is, I think, a good example of what you're talking about. There's also the red in a broad eave with one red eye of cloud through a narrow opening, a green flowered cleft. Out of the stare of sky and soil, they came into a mighty home of emerald dusk. So this would be describing so I guess what happens, I saw it more clearly this time. I didn't quite get it first, but there's like a procession. Savitri and her parents, like their retinue, they're going to bring her to her new home with Satyavan and his family. And they bring her there and they're full of strong emotion and let her go. And then she enters into her new life with them. She goes from being a princess and all the trappings of her palace life and to living, as Aurobindo says, as a serf. In this new context, and you know, being a servant of Satyavan's Ashwapati's family, I still had a lot of trouble with that. The first part of this canto, I want to believe that it makes sense, the wording of everything, but I get what happens in basic terms, I think, now. Whereas I didn't quite at first.
Yes, interesting. This the narrow opening. So it seems like in the landscape, there is this narrow passage for them to actually enter the space where the Shalva marches are, right? The Diyamatsana and Satyavan live. I hadn't seen that before.
So the Shalva marches, would that be like a geographic, like an area then?
That's... Yeah, yes.
Do you know that place?
No, but it is described as the area where they live, where the hermitage is. The hermitage is in the Shalva marches.
Okay, that's also an emerald line.
Yeah.
I wrote down a note for Shalva, a country in Western India. Huh. So I don't think it's identified as a place today or named as a place today, but it was from the Mahabharata that this word came. And I don't remember where I got that note, probably from Rand Hicks's dictionary.
But it must be near the foothills of the Himalayas, at least, because of these massive mountains that are described. I don't think there are such massive mountains in the Indian continent below the Himalayas.
I imagine it is part of the peninsula that extends down, but part of the India that's spreads from what's now Pakistan.
Yeah, to, maybe Kashmir or Pakistan.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then Madra would be the home of Satyavan's parents.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
And my note says a country northwest of Hindustan. Northwest of Hindustan. So that sounds like that's maybe in the same area I mean, rarely, in a very rough sense. Going back to that sentence that we were talking about at the beginning here, on the first page, the last time I read it through, it made sense to me. All was fulfilled. The heart of Satyavan, the heart of Savitri, flower sweet and adamant, passionate, had chosen, and on her strength's unbending road, forced. So the heart of Savitri chose and forced, had chosen, and on her strength's unbending road, had forced to its issue the long cosmic curve. The heart of Savitri was affecting the cosmic curve of fate.
So technically, all was fulfilled is the subject. And then the all.
Well, I think the heart of Savitri starts a clause. At least that's the way I read it. All was fulfilled. That is not there.
I don't like the that there. That doesn't make it doesn't sound right for me.
It doesn't have to be spoken. At least that's how I understand what's happening. All was fulfilled. The heart of Savitri had chosen and forced. All of this was fulfilled.
Yeah.
That the heart of Savitri had done.
Maybe now that all was fulfilled, now that the heart of Savitri had chosen.
So you're saying it's like a colon after all was fulfilled.
I would even put a full stop. All was fulfilled, period. The heart of Savitri chose.
No, I think the fulfillment was the result of the heart, what the heart of Savitri had done here.
Exactly.
So they're united in that sentence. I mean, a lot of times when we speak, I don't know whether this is what Sri Aurobindo was doing, but this is how I understand it. A lot of times when we speak, we just leave out conjunction, which that can be a conjunction. Just leave it out and go on and state the subordinate clause.
Yeah, but they're there to help us not be confused. So leaving them out is not a good idea. By the way, what does Ananki mean? I was wondering about that.
It means necessity. It's the Greek, I think it's the Greek for fate.
I would maybe use MDA if I were editing this. I think, and maybe just to help on, chunk the sentence, let's just add for the sake of readability of that in there. Would it make sense if it were to read, all was fulfilled that the heart of Savitri M-dash, flower sweet and adamant, passionate and calm, M-dash, had chosen on her strength's unbending road, had chosen and on her strength's unbending road forced to its issue the long cosmic curve. But even that wouldn't quite make sense.
Yeah, that's right, because flower sweet and adamant, passionate and calm are all adjectives referring to the heart of Savitri.
Yeah. Well, that's why I would put the M dashes there to like set off that clause and then continue at the other end.
I would separate off force to its issue with commas before and after, but that's me, you know?
Yeah, we would need something for that last phrase. Force to. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Forced to its issue. In other words, that's a consequence of her heart choosing, of her heart's choice,
mm-hmm.
her withdrawal was fulfilled.
Yeah, her heart is what forced the long cosmic curve to its result. Her heart's choice. Well,
yeah.
I guess we can put our editor's pens away for the moment now.
It's nice to find something, you know, that's a little, you know, something to work with, and
something to battle with.
Yeah.
Professional bias.
It would otherwise be very hard to improve on the text as a whole. We need to find our little chinks of possible imperfection.
But. Well, we find them in the synthesis of yoga. There are sometimes the sentences can be very long and very hard to understand as a result. He has his weaknesses, Aurobindo.
So I'm looking at on page 470 in the center, still veiled from her was the silent being within, who sees life's drama pass with unmoved eyes. It's that seems to be like the key to where she's at in her yoga. Yeah, she's dealing with all these feelings, but she has not yet arrived at that silent being within. She may know about it and have momentary glimpses of it, but it is still veiled from her. So to me, that's really the heart of Savitri's yoga.
Because it says at the beginning that she didn't remember, and then sort of three quarters of the way through that she suddenly remembered. So I think she's sort of hiding herself from herself, right? So,
well, isn't that what we do until yeah. we wake up a little more? Until the doom of time hits us over the head.
Yeah. Just a couple of sentences or lines later, he does mention glimpses or flashes, like you were implying, yeah. Andrea.
Yeah. Because we all know it, right? We all know it because we get these moments of grace where we are in that kind of infinite space of union.
Besides which, any passionate love affair is doomed in the long term. It's an ephemeral thing.
Yep. Yeah. Even if it returns for lifetimes and after lifetimes, but there's still always the.
Yeah, I was thinking of it. It's a silly kind of reference because it's probably based on these kinds of legends. But I was thinking, so in the Super Zero universe, you have Hawk Man and Hawk Mistress, who are these two souls that reincarnate through the generations, and they're always together. So these are super. This is in superhero. Are they DC or Marvel? I can't remember which one they are.
Well, this seems archetypal to me in that sense too. And in the bottom, at the bottom of 471, when she's crying out to Satyavan, she says, "For soon we part, and who shall know how long before the great wheel, in its monstrous round, restore us to each other and our love." So she, although she is hiding from or not fully in touch with the silent being, she has this intuition of the cosmic cycles and the preciousness of this event of her and Satyavan having met, having found each other, which, as we as you recall, was almost accidental. It was not accidental, but it could have not happened. They could have not glanced at each other at just the right time. And so there's this kind of destined meeting. But it seems like they've been at it for a long time. They've been apart from each other for like aeons and lifetimes. And, you know, now I've found each other again. Another integral philosopher, Ken Wilber, had a similar story with his wife, Treya. And it was very similar because, and he wrote a whole book about it, which, by the way, was turned into a movie, a Hollywood movie, like last year. And I watched it, and it was good.
Well, what was it called?
It's called Grace and Grit.
Oh yeah.
And it's the story of their time together after having met and, you know, fallen in love and recognized each other, recognized their being in each other, and then I think 10 days after they were married, she was diagnosed with cancer.
Yeah, they were on their honeymoon when they found out.
That's right. It's a beautiful book. It was one of the
book is beautiful. The book is gorgeous. I remember it. Yeah.
It includes a lot of her writing. And part of what I think is good about it is that that Ken tells their story, but incorporates her journals and her letters and gives her a voice in the narrative. The movie is very Hollywood. Which is fine. I mean, it is what it is. But it had that same theme, the book more so than the movie, of this like cosmic meeting, this cosmic reunion, and like the archetypal, like, you know, marriage of spirit and matter of heaven and earth. And it's such a contrast to the daily round, which she falls into of service and cleaning and cooking and whatever else she must do, with this esoteric and much vaster and much more intense round that she's also aware of. That was another thing that I noticed the second time we read.
I appreciated the second version. I think I got the story the second time around. I didn't really get it first time. So,
yeah.
All the discussion helps make the pieces come together.
I'm curious why she wouldn't have told Satyavan yet about his fate, or does that come later?
No, I really believe it is because she doesn't want to burden him. You know, when you love someone, you want them to be happy, and she doesn't want to burden him. I mean, personally, I would prefer to speak the truth, but this is what she did. Yeah. It's like another part of her sacrifice, that she protects his knowing.
Mm. It's not very contemporary, is it, though? I mean,
no.
Today we sort of feel that the person who's on the sort of shorter end of the stick should be informed, right? And for a certain good reason. I mean, it's easier to deal with, it may not be easier to deal with death knowing it's coming, but it's part of the process of dying to figure that out. That's the way we understand it.
Yeah.
Well, Sri Aurobindo says she did it for love. I mean, it's in the text here that she didn't tell him out of love. I was looking for it and I can't find it now right now, but too well she loved to speak a fateful word and lay her burden on his happy head. There it is. It's at the top of page 472.
Yes, we would argue that these days. I agree.
And of course he's not dying. He's living. You know, I mean, He's going to die, but he's not dying, right?
Right. Yeah. He doesn't have a terminal illness or anything.
It's a bit different from somebody having a terminal illness. It's a bit different. He's just doing what he's doing normally. It's just that the fates decree that he's...
And just after that line, it says that he sometimes half understood, or at least felt.
Exactly.
He would, you know, when you're so tuned into each other, you feel these states.
I don't know if heroic is the right word, but this kind of act of suppression. She pressed the outsurging grief back mm-hmm. into her breast. I don't even know how you would do that, but it seems like a heroic effort on her part to keep the secret.
Yeah. I think it's part of her sacrifice. Mm.
Yeah. It's part of her sadhana. We're in the book of her yoga.
So we're good for today? Shall we close up with a meditation?
Yeah. Before we do, I'm going to pause this just 1 second.
This was good. Thank you.
It was really good.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Good way to start the new year.
Beautiful. Yes.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Best wishes on your trip, Marco.
Thank you.
Yes. Blessings. Thank you.